In America, it's become customary to say that issues really have little to do with our presidential elections, that we Americans vote according to our reaction to President Eisenhower's fatherly smile or our reaction to Pat Nixon's good black Republican cloth coat. Obviously, this is an overstatement. Obviously, issues have had a role. Mr. Truman in 48 managed to make the lack of New Dealism of the 80th Congress a vote-getting issue. The Republicans in 1952 with the famous formula K1C2, communism, corruption, and Korea, obviously garnered votes. Today, we are going to try to talk about the likely issues in the forthcoming campaign. And to do it with as much clarity as possible, may I suggest that we divide our discussions into two parts. The first, what we believe the likely issues to be, whether we like them or not, and the other, what we ourselves think the issues ought to be. To discuss this problem today, our panel to my right, Mr. James R. Shepley, Chief of National Correspondence of Time and Life magazine. In the center, Mr. Edwin L. Dale, Jr., the economics specialist of the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, and the author of the very interesting new volume, Conservatives in Power. And across the table from me, Mr. Sidney Hyman, a political writer, a frequent contributor to Reporter magazine, and author of the well-known volume, The American President. To begin, then, on this question of what we think various groups in America are likely to want the issues to be, the way people will discuss the campaign. Mr. Shepley, may I ask you to start by suggesting what the rather undistinguishable part of the public which is neither very liberal nor very conservative, will want the issues to be.
And if you add to that the part of the public that is not very partisan.
Not very partisan, and, right.
And in short, the majority of the American people. I would think that there will be two issues that will influence them more than any other. One of them will be an issue that one could describe as foreign policy or how we're doing versus the Russians or however you would like to establish it. But I think in general it is the competition with the Soviet Union for supremacy and on the planet Earth. That issue will influence them greatly, and the other one will be one which my colleague here, Mr. Dale, will know a lot more about than I do, how their pocketbook seems to be affected in the latter half of this year by economic forces far beyond their own control.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Dale, disregarding what you yourself think the issue should be, what do you think a typical Republican conservative business executive, for example, will see as the prime issues?
I think he will see as the prime issue the ones we're all familiar with, the size of the budget and the level of taxes and the level of inflation or the inflationary forces at work in society, and in a connection with that, the status of the labor unions and which party he thinks might deal more severely with the labor unions. He will all be prosperous, I believe, at that time, and so to the extent that the pocketbook issue exists, it will be more along this line from the point of view of the conservative, which party he believes will try to keep a hold down on the budget, a hold down on taxes, and, of course, inevitably, a hold down on public services along with that.
No, not much emphasis on foreign policy, except as it affects the budget.
I don't see how he could, I don't really see how the issue of foreign policy is going to come up, and I think that the conservative would be very unlikely to, as it were, vote Democratic because he liked the foreign policy of the Democratic candidate.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Hyman, again, disregarding your own point of view, the issues as seen by the liberal Democratic publicist, professor, etc.
I think he would begin by saying that the old divisions between domestic and foreign affairs have ceased to exist, that domestic and foreign affairs are just one big problem, that what you can do domestically is going to determine what you can do in the field of foreign affairs, what happens in the field of foreign affairs will determine what happens domestically. I think he would say that if you are moving in the new phase of the Cold War from a military to an economic phase, the character of your internal economy, your capacity to grow, is going to have a decisive effect on what you can do in this new dimension of economic competition abroad. Therefore, he would begin by urging the expansion of the economy in some way beyond what it has expanded in the past in order to be able to meet the new character of the competition in the field of foreign affairs.
About equal emphasis on
foreign...
Indivisible emphasis.
They would be one affair.
And may I comment that I share Sidney's point that the typical liberal will have his greatest emphasis on precisely this, expansion of the economy. The typical conservative will be afraid of the measures that our liberal would take to achieve that expansion, which would include bigger budgets and would include tight money. And I would hope that the election would crystallize what is a very real debate on this question. I believe that the Democrats, in particular, face a tremendous dilemma here. They can, if they want to, that is, the candidate of the Democratic Party, can, if he wants to, accept the so-called new inflation theories, which is that it isn't because of big budgets and cheap money. And he can say, all right, I can raise the budget, and I can lower interest rates, and I can do more for the public, and I can do more foreign aid, and I can shoot more missiles into space, and I can have more missiles against the Russians, all of it without any inflation. And I can have a higher rate of growth to make it possible for me to do all these things. And the conservative will simply have to fight him on those grounds and say that this is phony economics. And I hope the election will crystallize this issue, because it's a very interesting debate.
I would agree with you, Mr. Dale, that I think it is a worthwhile debate. And I think that you have the makings of a debate already
right.
In the character of the advisory council of the Democratic National Committee has put forward one point of view. Ironically, it is very close to the point of view put forward by the Rockefeller Brother reports. You have an opposing body. I don't think that they have shown, the liberal, Republican or Democrat, who tends to think alike on this, have shown...
Now, Mr. Shepley, this majority fellow of yours seems to me in his approach to be a little closer to Mr. Hyman's liberal than to Mr. Dale's conservative, in the sense that he has this kind of indivisible emphasis on foreign and domestic affairs, and in his casualness about inflation. Or do I misread your statements?
No. But I think this majority fellow that we're talking about would be quite surprised to find himself identified either as a liberal or a conservative. And I, you know, it might be well for the country if the clear resolution that Mr. Hyman and Mr. Dale would like to see came about, but I'd for one, doubt it very much. I can see that it might if Senator Humphrey were the candidate of the Democratic Party. I doubt that either of these gentlemen are prepared to tell me they think that he will be. If the candidate were Senator Kennedy or Senator Lyndon Johnson, who might possibly be the Democratic candidate, I would find it quite extraordinary if there was much of a difference between either of those gentlemen and Vice President Nixon on the very issues that you're talking about.
Are you sure about that, Mr. Shepley? What about high interest rates? Don't you expect that Kennedy or Johnson or Humphrey would hit pretty hard on that issue?
I think Senator Humphrey would undoubtedly make it a major issue. I would be quite surprised if Senator Kennedy chose this as his favorite issue, and I would be even more surprised. It's possible that Senator Johnson might, but I think it might be difficult to draw Vice President Nixon into much of an argument on the question.
I think that if you put the chief Democratic candidates in the room together, Johnson, Stevenson, Kennedy, Symington, and Humphrey, and have them talk to each other, I think they would be in substantial agreement on what the economic policy should be. You've had, on the other hand, I do think I would also agree that privately, perhaps Mr. Nixon would agree with them. I do think that the party position will make the difference between what they can say publicly and what they cannot say publicly.
Well, won't all of these candidates be inclined, Mr. Hyman, to decide at the time and in the moment what they think the national humor and the mood is. Don't candidates really talk to their appraisal of the national mood at the time in the last or 3 months of the campaign?
May I cut in here for a moment on this question of national mood? Time Inc., in both of its publications some 6 or 7 weeks ago, suggested that there may be a great sleeper issue coming up for your majority fellow. The issue of this vague sense of national purpose. Are we as a nation fulfilling anything that we want to fulfill? At that time, there was a great discussion of that, as you recall. Mr. Rockefeller said it was the issue. George Kennan made a very widely quoted speech to that effect. Is this something which you gentlemen see as a real possibility, as a sleeper issue, that that candidate who best seems to represent the national purpose in a good sense will have a great advantage?
What do you think?
Well, thank you, Mr. Goldman. I do believe that that you put your finger on it, that there will be... all of our public speakers have drawn attention, at least in the last year or so, not 5 or 10 years ago, but recently, to the fact that there seems to be a lack of certainty or clarity or delineation in the minds of any of us, let alone the great majority of the American people, as to what our national purpose is. And yet, every man who stands before the public and speaks to these questions says that we should have a national purpose and calls for a national purpose, which most of them are then leave to the editorial writers or someone. In any event, they very seldom make any attempt to write a national purpose.
Yes, we had 5 programs on the open mind to define the national purpose.
Well,
and all that happened at the end was that our participants were all depressed at their inability to find their way to a
maybe you can bring that into some clarity for an election, though, to this extent, that it almost in the nature of things would have to be Mr. Nixon defending and the Democrat attacking on this one count, wouldn't it?
I think that is probably a fair statement. In any event, there'll be a natural tendency to blame the lack of national purpose on the administration headed by President Eisenhower, which happens to be responsible for our affairs. If Mr. Nixon is as good and astute a politician as I think he is, and I believe you probably do too, He will try to avoid being on the defensive about it, and even, I would suppose, if he has to cut ground, new ground, away from the present administration.
I think this discussion of national purpose could very well focus on to a debate about what the nature of the presidency is. We've had a rather distinct point of view presented to us by President Eisenhower for the last 7 years, and if you assume that the statement of national purpose comes from the president, or at least a source of it, what do you expect of the president to do beyond merely stating things? Do you mean to have a president who would be so far above politics as to be invisible? Do you mean to have a president who would be like a patriot king leading troops into battle? And I think I see the makings, at least on the Democratic side, of a narrowing down of this big and amorphous discussion of about national purpose to a discussion of what specifically is the role of the presidency in our scheme of government. And I think also, as an aspect of this particular discussion, you are going to have them put the issue, do you think that we are served by our government if we have a party of one party controlling the executive and the party controlling the Congress? I think we have a very clear-cut constitutional issue shaping up here.
Mr. Hyman, excuse me a moment, one moment. Are you suggesting that this will be an issue, or have we now moved over to our second point, namely that you think it ought to be an issue?
No, I think that you will, as you hear the beginnings, the advance wave, the whisperings of the wind of these various candidates, we don't follow these candidates around in the primaries as they are bidding for the nomination. The reportage is rather sketchy. But if you sit down and read all their speeches, as I've had occasion to do, you find one after another edging up to this and trying to infiltrate the public mind with this thing that they will eventually, when the focus of all attention is on them, I think they will state the issue in terms of what kind of a president do you want the president of the next 4 years to be.
Well, Mr. Sheppey, I cut you off.
Well, yes. If My past experience in covering political campaigns serves me at all. I suspect that the language will be far more candid, succinct, and abrupt than you've just phrased it. And I would guess that the Democrats essentially are going to charge that President Eisenhower has not given the country leadership. And they will attempt to say why he hasn't given leadership and how he hasn't given leadership, and they will portray him as a president who conceives himself a magistrate to look over all the debate below and remain out of the cockpit because he's been very successful with this image. Mm. However, they may make some headway against the so-called failure of leadership of the Eisenhower administration.
Except they're not running against him.
But they're not running against him. They're running against Nixon, and I would guess that Nixon will make an effective show of a man at least trying to demonstrate leadership or what he would consider to be questions and positions which show leadership.
I agree with that. They're not running against Mr. Eisenhower. They're running against the Democrats. Be running against Mr. Nixon, but the Republicans were running against Adlai Stevenson in '52, and yet he is saddled with the Truman record.
Sure.
And I think that as Mr. Stevenson had a terrible time trying to disassociate himself from the Truman record, whether he should have or should not is another question. But at least he tried. I think similarly, Mr. Nixon will try to disassociate himself.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I think he's preempting the liberal position that Rockefeller occupied. Nixon is free to do it now.
Yeah, but it's a dangerous thing to try to disassociate himself too much from a man who has been so clearly a popular president.
But Mr. Dale, how can Nixon run as an anti-inflation candidate after the Steele settlement in which he played so large a role?
Because the Steele settlement is not inflationary.
Suppose it becomes inflationary in the next few weeks. Don't you expect it to?
Oh, no. No, this has been the most badly reported settlement that I can remember. The union won less than half of the typical post-war gain. It's just barely over the margin where it pushes up the company's costs, and you won't get a price increase in steel till the turn of the year, if then.
After the election.
That's part of the deal, after all. But let me to return, if I may, to that economic
issue. Excuse me one moment. You picture this as a deal.
I think that Nixon... if you want to call it a deal, that has bad connotations. What Nixon did at the last moment was say, if you fellas take this settlement, will you feel forced to raise prices? And the answer he got was, well, no, not at least until the next wage increase goes in, which is December the 1st.
And that's a year away.
And that's a year away. And I think that's perfectly legitimate.
And after the election.
And also after the election, so everybody wins. But it is also true that this is a much, much cheaper settlement than it's been painted. However, before we get off onto that itself, I still think that my economic issue will be the one that will, in fact, occupy the headlines one way or another, and also ought to. So I will combine
both
of those.
You say here a very interesting proposition. Let me read this sentence to you, gentlemen. You say it's a reasonable proposition that if there are party differences in the U.S. at all, they are economic differences. And you subordinate foreign policy issues to that.
As party issues, very definitely.
I agree that there are these differences in economic issues. I think that the differences in foreign affairs are also fundamental. The trouble with the differences in foreign affairs, they are not in terms of objectives. Everyone wants peace, everyone wants security. It's a question of whether the means you choose are adjusted to the ends you pursue. And I think the liberal Democrats will argue that the means that have been used are either not adequate for the end that you wish to pursue in foreign affairs, or that they will carry you away from the objective.
I agree.
And I think this is a legitimate, and I believe this is an emergent debate.
All right, but you see, even that one will get Mr. Nixon replying. They want to clear more slums. They want to clear more streams. They want to spend more on foreign aid. They want to spend more on missiles. Where are they going to get the money? And in effect, he will be saying, if you elect, and whichever one of them gets nominated, I believe, if you elect Johnson or if you elect Stevenson, you will find your dollar disappearing in 5 years, and you will find your taxes going up. And I really think this is where the debate is going to crystallize.
Well, at the present state of events, when things are prosperous,
which there will be, I think.
The market goes up and down, but breaks through the averages every third or fourth week, and people are fairly well off. Nixon would be a political fool if he didn't run on the present fiscal policies of the Eisenhower administration and say, as Mr. Dale suggests, that the issue against his Democratic opponent is whether or not he has fiscal responsibility or fiscal morality or whatever you want to call it, or whether he is so interested in appeasing special interests and special groups that he's willing to spend money on anything, anytime, anywhere. And if he is, please tell us where he's going to get the money to do it. And he may even point out that our present taxes were set up in a great war emergency and were geared to an emergency. And with that, we have difficulty having a balanced budget, and the Republican position will certainly be enhanced by the fact that Mr. Eisenhower may have, as he says he will, a balanced budget this year.
Well, before our time goes further, let's shift from this first point of realities, what we think people will make the issues, to the ideal, what we as a group think the issues ought to be. There's a sentence in Walter Lippmann that raises some interesting problems. He says, "The case against Eisenhower's peace and prosperity is that we are not producing enough wealth of the right kind. Our economic growth is slower than is required by our position in the world. And of the wealth we do produce, too large a proportion goes into consumer goods." This is, of course, Mr. Walter Lippmann's statement of the ideal issue of the campaign. I see an agreement.
Yes. I would think so. I think that you have a fundamental decision to make and a social decision to make as to how you are going to allocate the productivity of the country. Are you going to allocate it to improve the quality of your public services, your schools, your roads?
Yeah.
This is a legitimate issue, and it ought to be argued out. This would go to the heart of what your tax policy ought to be.
Absolutely.
Because this is one of the ways you can reallocate the resources of the country without coercion.
It's one of the few really effective ways, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, an indirect way and yet a direct way.
Well, I wondered how soon Mr. Hyman was going to bring Professor Galbraith to the table. And
we brought Professor Lippmann here.
Well, Professor Lippmann is borrowing
a
phrase, as a journalist is entitled to. And the only thing that I would ask Mr. Hyman is, what is the way in which he sees the Democratic candidate making a popular issue out of Professor Galbraith's argument?
I think, in the first place, I don't think he would accept Professor Galbraith's argument in toto. I think he would say, first of all, that we are not as affluent as we think. Some 20% of our people have a per capita income less than $2,000. I think that's
correct. Right, yeah.
So that you still have the problem of the submerged lower fifth of the country, and you have to do something about them. Beyond that, I think the Democratic candidate is in a tough position to say you're going to have a tougher tax schedule. We are now talking, by the way, about not what will be the, we're talking about what ought to
what,
be the
what
discussion,
ought to be, yes.
what would be relevant. This would be a relevant debate. How do you reallocate your resources of the country? And that's what I'm talking about right now.
Of course, I'd like to ask how that can become an issue. I think it is the great question confronting the society, a combination of the two points. How do you get a little more rapid rate of growth? Mm-hmm. And then how do you allocate the wealth that you produce more towards a better quality society, whether it be cleaner streams or more aid to India?
You ask how does this become an issue?
I think
it can become an issue in these terms. With a population explosion, you have the problem of schools, and enough people in the suburbs are going to start worrying about their schools, and they are going to be acting on candidates. You have in most metropolitan areas, you have transportation jams. People living in cities are going to start worrying about this. Old people are going to start worrying about medical care. And you get enough of these people who are losing out in this affluent society are going to bring their pressure to bear on candidates through the pressure from below.
Well, all I mean is that nobody's against improving these public qualities. Well,
who right, is right. going to speak up
the other side.
Actually against education or highways?
Exactly.
They'll speak up against the way in which it's done, whether it's done always by the federal government or whether there is some local responsibility for schools the care of the aged and the unfortunate.
Or they might say that if we raise taxes anymore, we'll slow down the growth so badly that we will have less wealth in the end. I mean, that's about the only defense you can make against the against the wish to devote more of our wealth to the public sector, which is what this really comes to. The only answer to it is that means higher taxes and therefore our growth will slow down, which is, of course, a debatable claim.
But aren't we a little bit off Mr. Hyman's point? It seems to me what he was saying is that an issue could be the charge that the Eisenhower administration has not, through any one of a number of instrumentalities, sufficiently promoted schools, parks, hospitals, etc.
Or foreign aid, even.
And then the other half of the quotation is foreign aid.
I thought Mr. Dale said rate of growth, and I would like to ask Mr. Dale, what should be, or what is the ideal rate of growth
The optimum named by Mr. Hyman's liberals is about 5% a year. Our historic rate is 3% a year, and in the last 6 years of Eisenhower, it's been less than 3% a year for a number of reasons. I think Nixon would go for 4, and will, in effect, pledge 4 if it comes to that.
Well, would you go for 5?
No, I wouldn't, personally.
I think
that's too much of a dream, but I think that in this particular decade, with the growth of the labor force that we'll have, that 4 is a pretty reasonable target.
What's your rate of growth?
I would split the difference between 4 and 5.
4.5%. It's a pretty.
But nobody's going to be against growth. The point. Nobody's going to be against growth. Nixon, if it gets into this high philosophical plane, would argue that the best way to get more rapid growth is to keep the government out, and the other fellows would argue it would be get the government in. I mean, to lower interest rates.
Mr. Shapley, do I detect on your part a certain skepticism as to the importance of this issue
of growth?
Yeah.
Well, we're talking now about what
ought to be,
what would be relevant in a great national campaign, right. And I think that the question of rate of growth may be the most important one before the society. Whether we should try to set up a fixed rate of growth, I mean, whether we should try to say we'll grow 4% or 5% every year, no matter what. I'm not certain. I can see how you might get into serious difficulties about trying to achieve a standard rate of growth, because growth has to do with capital expansion. You're having more factories with more jobs, and someone has to build them. Then after they're built, they to keep effective, they have to produce something, and then eventually we're producing more than we can use, and we have difficulties that way. But if we can establish for the United States, a sensible program of economic growth, especially since the Russians make this their number one pitch to the emergent peoples. They say, we have this rate of growth thing licked. Look at us. In 40 years, we've come from a primitive society to a modern society that now is out ahead of the great United States. Technologically, our rockets are going higher and farther and faster and so forth. It's a pretty good piece of propaganda, and it's heard by people who would like to achieve some rate of growth themselves, and it's never quite been clarified in the.
That's right. Well, now
we've never clarified what we ought to do about growth.
Well, no, and that's why the debate, if any,
but you all
should
see
be on how you achieve a higher rate of growth on a sustainable basis.
But I see our time is running out here, and do I detect a consensus here that an important, good national issue would be this problem?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, excuse me.
Thank you.
With some hesitancy on your part. For what seems to me a very sensible and coherent discussion here, thank you, Mr. Shepley, Mr. Dale, and Mr. Hyman.
WRCA has just presented The Open Mind. Your host on The Open Mind was Eric F. Goldman, professor of history at Princeton University. Professor Goldman's guests today were Mr. James Shepley, Mr. Edwin L. Dale, Jr., and Mr. Sidney Hyman. Next week, The Open Mind will return to its regular time of 1 p.m., when the subject will be Why the Civil War Boom. If you have any comments or questions on today's program, or if you have any suggestions for future programs, send them to the Open Mind, WRCA TV. Wrap up the weekend in newsworthy style as Ken Banghart brings you the latest reports tonight at the 11th hour on Channel 4.
Here's Big Otis.
The O stands for the Oats in Kellogg's O'Kays. The K stands for Kellogg's in Kellogg's O'Kays. Look for the O, hooray for the K. Get your protein every day. Oats taste their very best in Kellogg's O'Kays.